Media.
Advertising agencies that function on a world scale also enjoy high returns on equity by being in a unique position to profit from the huge consumer multinational companies that sell their products the world over. If one of these multinational companies wants to launch an advertising campaign, it has to use an advertising agency like Interpublic, the second largest advertising agency in the world. Interpublic becomes the toll bridge to the consumer that the multinational manufacturer must cross. This is the line of reasoning that Warren followed when he bought 17% of Interpublic. Businesses that provide repetitive consumer services that people and businesses are consistently in need of are also attractive to Warren Buffett. And the services provided can be performed by non-union workers, often with limited skills, who are hired on an as-needed basis. This odd segment of the business world includes such companies as ServiceMaster, which provides pest control, professional cleaning, maid service, and lawn care. Rollins, which runs Orkin, the world's largest pest and termite control service, and also provides security services to homes and businesses. We all know that at tax time, H&R Block is there to save our necks by filling in all those blank lines with the right tax numbers. All of these companies earn high rates of return on equity. This segment of Warren's toll bridge world also includes the credit card companies that he has invested in, such as American Express and Dean Witter Discover. Every time you use one of these companies' cards, it charges the merchant a fee or toll. If you fail to pay your credit card bill within your grace period, they get a chance to charge you a fee as well. Millions of little tolls, taxed to each transaction, adds up. Also, these strange credit card toll bridges don't need huge plants and equipment that suck up capital. The key to these kinds of companies is that they provide necessary services but require little in the way of capital expenditures or a highly paid educated workforce. Additionally, there is no such thing as product obsolescence. Once the management and infrastructure are in place, the company can hire and fire employees as the work demand dictates. You hire a person to work as a security guard for $8 an hour, give him a few hours of training, and then rent him out at $25 an hour. When there is no work, you don't have to pay him. Also, no one has to spend money and energy on upgrading or developing new products. The money these companies make goes directly into their pockets and can be spent on expanding operations, paying out dividends, or buying back stock. As long as the locusts keep coming, the termites keep eating, the thieves keep thieving, shoppers keep using credit cards, and governments keep taxing us, these companies will make money. Lots of it for a long time. The best way to start your search for the excellent toll bridge is to stand outside the supermarket, 7-Eleven or convenience store, or that drugstore we talked about, and try to list the brand name products the store must carry to be in business. This mental process is much better than thumbing through endless financial magazines and guides searching for the elusive company of your dreams. The products you come up with will lead you to the companies that are sitting on consumer jackpots of gold and getting high returns on equity and superior results for their owners. So get a pen and paper out and start guessing. One of Warren's prerequisites for an investment is that he understands what the company makes and how the product is used. He likes products that don't become obsolete because of some technical advancement. This means a lot of high-tech companies are ruled out. It doesn't mean that you can't invest in them using Warren's principles. It just means that if you don't understand what they do, you had better leave them alone. Where do you go after you found the name of a company that manufactures a product that you understand? You can start by looking at the product package to find out where it was manufactured. Then use the wonderful people at your long-distance telephone company. call information and get the phone number of the company in question. It may just be that the company you have chosen is a subsidiary of another corporation. For instance, Haynes Hosiery is a part of Sara Lee. Yes, the same people who are making your cheesecake are also draping women's legs in hosiery. It may also be that the address on the label was for a manufacturing plant and not for the corporate offices. All right, you call the company and ask them for the phone number of the home office. You then call the home office. Tell the receptionist that you would like a copy of the company's annual report. The receptionist will more than likely connect you with somebody in shareholder relations. If that happens, tell the person in that department that you'd like a copy of the company's annual report. The person at the other end of the line will take your address and send you a copy free of charge. That's right, free of charge. The operator may tell you that the company is not publicly traded and doesn't issue an annual report to the public. This would be the case if you tried to get the annual report of, say, the Chanel Corporation, makers of that elegant fragrance Chanel No. 5. If that is the case, you would be out of luck and you should go on to your next company. If, however, the annual report is in the mail and you know that the company is publicly traded and where its home office is, and you know one or several of the products it makes, you are in a position to start using some of the resources that the financial and information sectors offer. Your first trip should be to the local library, where you will find a set of books called The Guide to Business Periodicals. This amazing set of books contain a listing by page, week, month, and year of every publication in which the company in question was mentioned. The guide dates back about 30 years, so you should start with the most recent and look for stories about your company that were published in major business periodicals like Fortune, Business Week, Forbes, and Smart Money. Though there may be countless other listings, these will more than likely give you a good overview of the company and the industry it is in. It's really amazing when you think about it. You get some hotshot reporter writing about the business you are interested in. A reporter who perhaps talked to the competitors, interviewed the heads of the company, and gleaned the opinions of all the big-name analysts that cover the stock. And the really nice thing is, you don't have to pay a thing for this service, because after you get the listing for the story, you go to the periodical desk in the library, and the librarian will tell you how to retrieve the story. More than likely, the library will either have the magazine or will have a copy of it on microfilm, and all for free. University libraries are often a better source of information than the local city library, especially if the university has a business school. As you are reading these stories, remember to take notes. List the names of the competitors and anybody quoted. You do this because at some future date you may want to contact them and ask them a few questions. I know what you're thinking. How can I call these people and ask them questions? Just pick up the phone and dial. Tell them that you run a small fund. So what if your fund only has one investor, you? Tell them you are thinking about investing in the company. 9 times out of 10, they'll be happy to talk to you about the company. Now that you've learned a little about the company, you can go back to the periodical desk at the library and inquire about a source book of financial information called the Value Line Investment Survey. It covers 1,700 different companies and lists key financial figures dating back 15 years. It is a key tool in the game and one that Warren regularly uses. It is full of important figures such as the earnings per share and return on equity computations. I highly recommend it. Another source of information is Moody's Guide, which can also be found at your library. Standard & Poor's stock reports also follows selected companies. Note that Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Value Line offer subscriptions. If you are serious about investing, then they are worth, yes, the investment. Look up the name of your company in Value Line and then turn to the page cited and read on. If you can't find the company listed in Value Line, try Moody's. There is one for New York Stock Exchange stocks and one for over-the-counter or OTC stocks. If you can't find your company listed by any of these services, call the company again and try to get annual reports dating back as many years as possible. After you have read the stories you found through the Guide to Business periodicals and have assembled the financial figures for the company for at least the last 7 years, you are ready to answer some key questions about the nature of the business. Namely, is it a commodity-type business or a consumer monopoly-type business, or is it something in between? You can also answer a few questions about the management. Does it have shareholders' interest at heart, or is it out to foolishly spend the shareholders' money on low-return projects? If things look enticing, you'll want to run the numbers for the return on equity and earnings growth over the last 8 to 10 years. You'll also want to calculate the company's value to you as an investor, using the equations we discussed earlier in the program. But remember, the earnings of a company must have strength, and the company's products have to be of a nature that will allow you to project the company's future earnings with a fair degree of comfort. Warren often refers to a circle of competence, using Bill Gates and his incredible company Microsoft as an example. He will say that Gates is probably the smartest and most creative manager in the business world today, and that the company is super. However, Warren says he's unable to predict with any comfort what the future earnings of the company will be, and therefore he can't calculate Microsoft's future value. If Warren is unable to calculate a company's future value, then the company will not fall in his circle of competence, and he will not consider it for investment. In Microsoft's case, he says that he just doesn't understand the business well enough to evaluate it, and if he can't evaluate it, he's not going to invest in it. But let's say the company you're considering is what you're looking for. At this point, you'd go on to the next step. The next step is really an adaptation of something the investment genius Philip Fisher wrote about in his enlightened 60s book, Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits. In it, he describes a process of investigation he calls the scuttlebutt approach. It is an investigative technique in which the prospective investor calls the competition and the customers of a business and asks them about the company in question. It's not unlike having coffee with an ex-girlfriend or ex-boyfriend of someone you are thinking about dating. Warren actually gets on the phone and calls the competition and asks what they think of a particular company. Or he may question someone he knows who has knowledge about a particular area of business. If you happen to be around Warren after he's gotten tanked up on 4 or 5 Coca-Colas, he may regale you with some of his early scuttlebutt escapades from his days at the Columbia School of Business. My favorite is when Warren finds out that his favorite professor, none other than Benjamin Graham, is chairman of an insurance company called Government Employees Insurance Company, GEICO. Young Warren, upon learning this, ventured over to the Columbia Library, looked up GEICO, and discovered that the company was located in Washington, D.C. So one Saturday, Warren hopped on a train and went down to Washington, D.C., arriving at GEICO's headquarters at about 11 o'clock in the morning. Upon finding the doors closed, he beat on the front door until a janitor answered. Warren asked the janitor in the building whom he could talk to about the company. The janitor, taking pity, told him a guy on the 6th floor might be able to help him. So Warren walked in, marched up to the 6th floor, and found none other than Lorimar Davidson, GEICO's chief investment officer, who later would become CEO. Davidson, flattered and impressed with Warren's desire to know about the company, spent 4 hours with him that day explaining the insurance business and how GEICO worked. And Warren became totally enamored with the company. As we noted, he later added GEICO to his circle of competence and over the next 40 years made over $1.7 billion on a $45 million investment in the company. Do the scuttlebutt? Yes. A service that investment houses can provide you with is a list of all the institutions that own a particular stock. I have found it amazingly informative to call up those institutions and ask to talk to the analyst who follows the company I'm interested in. I tell him I run a small investment fund and that I'm thinking about adding the company in question to my portfolio. I have yet to have an analyst turn me away. Analysts, as a lot, are a very talkative group, and invariably they will expound on the factors that made them interested in buying the stock. Sometimes you'll find out why they wish they hadn't bought the stock. But remember, I've already done my homework on the company, and I can talk intelligently about the business and ask pointed, timely questions. Another thing I like to do is go into a store that is selling the products of a business I'm thinking about buying. I'll ask the store manager how that particular product is selling. When Philip Morris dropped the price of Marlboros to win back sales that were being lost to the bargain brands, I started asking convenience shop clerks if the drop in price of Marlboros had stimulated sales. All said that it had. Weeks before, the press reported to the public that the drop in sales price was stimulating sales and allowing Philip Morris to regain the market share, I already knew that their strategy was working. Warren does the scuttlebutt. Philip Fisher does the scuttlebutt. David, my co-author, and I do the scuttlebutt, and so can you. Be creative and have fun. The worst thing that will happen is someone won't answer your question. The best thing that you may end up with is a friend. Anybody can do these things. You don't need an MBA, and you don't need to work for a big Wall Street investment house. All you need to do is spend some time in the library reading and making a few phone calls. Don't be shy. After all, it is your money, and if you are not willing to do at least a little work on your investment decisions, then it probably won't be your money for very long. What throws most Warren watchers is that he will sometimes buy into a business when prospects seem the bleakest. He did this most recently with his early 1990s purchase of stock in Wells Fargo Bank. Previous investments of this kind include the purchase of stock in American Express in the late 60s and the purchase of his interest in Geico in the 70s. To understand this, you have to remember that Graham believed that, since the majority of players in the stock market were short-term oriented, they placed 90% of their valuing effort into interpreting present results. That is to say, if a company had a bad year, the stock market would beat the price of the stock way down, even if all the preceding years had produced excellent results. To Benjamin Graham, Warren's teacher, this presented great opportunity to the investor who could take a long-term view. Warren discovered that short-term volatility is what creates opportunity for the long-term investor. Let me give you a practical example. Let's say that you own a small ski resort. You've been in the business for the last 30 years, and every year you made net profits of approximately $300,000. Occasionally, you had a really great year and you made around $600,000. You also occasionally had a really bad year when it didn't snow and you didn't make any money. Would you value your ski resort business for less money in the year that it didn't snow and you didn't make any money? Probably not. You know that occasional weather cycles will once in a while bring you a really bad year, just as they will bring you an occasional really great year. Those are just the ups and downs of your business. And if you were valuing your business, you would take those ups and downs into account. Makes sense, doesn't it? But if your ski resort was a publicly traded company, the stock market, being short-term motivated, would revalue your business every year as the earnings fluctuated. In really great years, they would value the ski resort at a lot more and send the price of the stock sky high. Likewise, in bad years, when it didn't snow, they would hammer the price of the stock into the ground. This kind of event happens periodically to almost all businesses, regardless of whether they are a commodity type or have a consumer monopoly working in their favor. The television and newspaper industry are dependent on advertising to produce income. However, advertising rates and revenue fluctuate with the business activity of the entire economy. If the economy falls into a recession, then advertising revenues fall as well, and newspapers and television networks make less money. Seeing this loss of revenues, the stock market reacts, causing the stock price of the newspaper or television company to plummet. Capital Cities ABC, Inc. fell victim to this weird, manic-depressive stock market behavior in 1990. Because of a business recession, advertising revenues started to drop, and Capital Cities reported that its net profit for 1990 would be approximately the same as in 1989. The stock market, used to Capital Cities growing its per-share earnings at approximately 27% a year, reacted violently to this news and in the space of 6 months drove the price of its stock down from $63.30 a share to $38 a share. Capital Cities lost 40% of its per-share price, all because it projected that things were going to be the same as they were last year. As we mentioned earlier, in 1995, Capital Cities and the Walt Disney Company agreed to merge. This caused the market to revalue Capital City stock upwards to $125 a share. If you bought it in 1990 for $38 a share and sold it in 1995 for $125 a share, your pre-tax annual compounding rate of return would be approximately 26%. With a per-share profit of $87. The point is this. If you have identified companies that have excellent management or a great consumer monopoly or both, it is possible to predict that they will most certainly survive a recession and more than likely come out of it in a better position than before. Recessions are hard on the weak, but they clean the field for the strong to take an even larger share when things improve. Occasionally, a company with a great consumer monopoly going in its favor does something that is both stupid and correctable. For Warren, that might be a buying opportunity as well. From 1936 to the mid-1970s, GEICO made a fortune insuring preferred drivers by operating at low cost and eliminating agents by operating via direct mail. But by the early 70s, new management decided that it would try and grow the company further by selling insurance to just about anyone who knocked on their door. This new philosophy of insuring any and all brought GEICO a large number of drivers who were accident-prone. More accidents meant that GEICO would lose more money, which it did. In 1975, it reported a net loss of $126 million, which placed it on the brink of insolvency. In response to this crisis, GEICO's board of directors hired Jack Byrne as the new chairman and president. Once on board, he approached Warren about investing in the company. Warren had only one concern, and that was whether GEICO would drop the unprofitable practice of insuring any and all drivers and return to the time-tested format of insuring just preferred drivers at low cost by direct mail. Byrne said that was the plan, and Warren made his investment. Here's another example of Warren seeing a corporate mistake as an investment opportunity. In the mid-60s, American Express, through a warehousing subsidiary, verified the existence of about $60 million worth of tanks filled with salad oil, owned by commodities dealer Anthony DeAngelis. DeAngelis, in turn, put up the salad oil as collateral for $60 million in loans. When DeAngelis failed to pay back the loans, his creditors moved to foreclose on the salad oil. But to the surprise of the creditors, the collateral they had loaned money against didn't exist. Since American Express had inadvertently verified the existence of the non-existent salad oil, They were held ultimately responsible to the creditors for their losses. American Express ended up having to pay off the creditors to the tune of approximately $60 million. This loss essentially sucked out the majority of American Express's equity base, and Wall Street responded by slamming its stock into the ground. Warren saw this and reasoned that even if the company lost the majority of its equity base, the inherent consumer monopolies of the credit card operations and traveler's checks business still remained intact. This loss of capital would not cause any long-term damage to American Express. Seeing this, Warren invested 40% of Buffett Partnership's investment capital in its stock and acquired for the Buffett Partners approximately 5% of American Express's outstanding stock. 2 years later, the market reappraised the stock upward, and Warren sold it and pocketed a cool $20 million profit. Think of it this way. Let's say you sued Coca-Cola and in 1993 won a judgment of $2.2 billion, or roughly what the company would have reported in net earnings that year. The stock market, hearing the news of your judgment, would kill Coca-Cola's stock price. But in truth, this loss would have little or no effect on the amount of money Coca-Cola would make in 1994. The intrinsic consumer monopoly Coca-Cola possesses would still be intact. Effectively, your $2.2 billion judgment would have been the same as if Coca-Cola had paid out a dividend of $2.2 billion in 1993. But instead of paying out the dividends to its shareholders, Coca-Cola would have paid it out to you. In the next year, 1994, Coca-Cola will show a net profit of $2.2 billion or better. By the time 1995 rolls around, no one will have remembered your 1993 judgment, and the price of Coca-Cola's stock will have returned to its pre-judgment price. How soon they forget. The lesson here is that the volatility of a company's stock price, caused by a recession, as in the case of Capital Cities, or the odd event, as in the case of GEICO, or American Express, can create an opportunity for the business perspective investor who has an eye on the long term. Earlier, we talked about how inflation can weaken certain companies more than others, and to avoid companies which must retool factories at increasing costs but are in no position to raise their prices to cover those costs. Well, now it's time to discuss the positive side of inflation. For Warren Buffett, inflation can be an opportunity. He didn't always see it as such. For many years, he felt that inflation was his worst enemy. And for the average investor, it is. However, homeowners who locked into 30-year 5% mortgages in the 1960s benefited from inflation, increasing their incomes while their mortgage payments remained fixed. Corporations also benefited in the 60s by convincing investors to loan them money for long periods of time at a fixed rate, which allowed them to pay back the loans in the future with inflated dollars. That $4,000 they loaned General Motors by purchasing a bond back in the 60s would have bought them 100% of a new car. When General Motors paid it back to them in the 90s, 30 years later, the return of the $4,000 in principle would buy them only approximately 25% of a new car. They have experienced a real loss of purchasing power. Almost no investment escapes the taxation of inflation. However, in 1983, Warren developed a theory that investments in companies that benefited from a strong consumer monopoly and required little capital to continue operations actually benefited from the effects of inflation. Invest in these businesses, and inflation helps you as an investor. It makes you richer. Warren has cited See's Candy Company to explain this phenomenon. In 1972, See's was earning around $2 million on $8 million of net tangible assets. Tangible assets are things like manufacturing plants and equipment, as opposed to intangible assets such as patents and copyrights. That means that sees plant and equipment and inventory produced after all expenses and taxes 25% earnings. Berkshire Hathaway paid roughly $25 million in 1972 for sees, which, working that calculator again, equates to an after-tax rate of return of 8%. Compare this to government bonds in 1972, which were paying a pre-tax rate of return of 5.8%. See's Candy after corporate income tax annual rate of return of 8% doesn't look too bad. Now let's say that a steel manufacturer, with poorer economics than See's, produced the same $2 million in net earnings, but on $18 million in net tangible assets. Blast furnaces for making steel cost considerably more than cooking pots for making candy. Two different businesses, both with net earnings of $2 million. The only difference is that See's produces its $2 million on a net tangible asset base of $8 million, and the steel manufacturer produces its $2 million on a net tangible asset base of $18 million. Now let's add in inflation. Over the next 10 years, prices double, as do sales and earnings. So both our businesses experience a doubling of earnings to $4 million. It's easy to figure out because all you have to do is sell the same number of units at the new inflated price, which everybody pays for with their new inflated salary. But there is just one problem. Production equipment wears out and eventually needs to be replaced. When these two companies go to replace their net tangible asset bases, the one that had a base of $8 million, See's, is going to have to come up with $16 million. Prices doubled not only for candy, but for plants and equipment. But the steel manufacturer, with a net tangible asset base of $18 million, is going to have to come up with $36 million, more than twice the money. Which company would you rather own, See's, which has to come up with $16 million, or the steel manufacturer, which has to come up with $36 million to stay in business? Get the point? The steel business manufacturer is going to require $20 million more of investment to produce the amount of earnings equivalent to See's. Inflation, though harmful to a great many businesses, can actually benefit the shareholders of companies that have a consumer monopoly working in their favor. Warren believes that diversification is something people do to protect themselves from their own stupidity. They lack the intelligence and expertise to make large investments in just a few businesses, so they must hedge against the folly of ignorance by having their capital spread out among many different investments. Benjamin Graham's investment strategy required that he have literally 100 or more stocks in his portfolio. He did this to hedge against the possibility that some of his investments would never perform as businesses and as stocks. The nature of the business, he felt, was locked into the numbers, and he was not all that concerned with really getting to know the businesses he owned. Warren followed Graham's strategy for a while, but in the end found that it was more like owning a zoo than a stock portfolio. Warren was greatly influenced by the writings of the late, great British economist, John Maynard Keynes. Keynes, a person of noted expertise in the field of investment, said he'd made the majority of his money in just a few different investments, the underlying businesses whose investment value he understood. In time, Warren adopted the concentrated portfolio approach, which means that he holds a small number of investments he really understands and intends holding for a long period of time. This allows the question of whether to allocate capital to an investment to be approached with the utmost seriousness. Warren believes that it is the seriousness with which he addresses the questions of what to invest in and at what price that decreases the risk. It is his commitment to the strategy of investing only in exceptional businesses at prices that make business sense that reduces his chances for loss. Warren has often said that a person would make fewer bad investment decisions if he were limited to just making 10 in his lifetime. Just 10. You would put a little work into making those 10 decisions, don't you think? It's amazing that intelligent, hard-working individuals think nothing of taking a large portion of their net worth and investing it in a company they know little or nothing about. If you asked them to invest in a local business, they would pepper you with questions. But let some stockbroker call them on the phone, and the next thing you know, they are partial owners of some exotic business. Bernard Baruch said, "Time and energy are required to keep abreast of the forces that may change the value of a security. While one can know all there is to know about a few issues, one cannot possibly know all one needs to know about a great many issues." Baruch, by the way, lived to be a very old and a very, very wealthy man. There are many ways to make and lose money on Wall Street. Some stock is always shooting to the moon, and around every corner, one of the chosen has fallen from grace. As Benjamin Graham loved to say, quoting Horace, "Many shall be restored that now are fallen, and many shall fall that are now in favor." Most people, and that includes investment managers, jump from one strategy to another, and in the process lose course and end up clinging to fear and greed as their guide through the turbulent seas of finance. Warren found religion in Graham. Graham gave Warren the conviction to weather the storms of doubt, which a falling market can foster even amongst the most courageous of Wall Street warriors. The realization that good things come to those who wait and who know what they are doing may seem a bit biblical, but Warren found this in Graham's philosophy of investing strictly from a business perspective. And Warren has followed that particular strategy with all the zeal of a Muslim on his way to Mecca. During those times in which the strategy offered no opportunities, when it cannot be applied, Warren just kicks back and waits. What do you mean he waits? That's right, he just sits back and waits. And sure enough, he has never had to wait very long before the market offers up to him a perfect opportunity to practice his particular brand of business perspective investing. Warren equates his strategy to waiting for the perfect pitch in a ball game in which the only way to strike out is to swing at the ball. Warren stands at bat carefully, waiting for the perfect pitch, and only on the perfect pitch will he swing his business perspective bat. Sure enough, after thousands of pitches and sometimes a year or two of waiting for the perfect pitch, a consumer monopoly with excellent management and a fantastic price comes sliding gently across the plate, and Warren slams it into the bleachers. A home run for Warren and another $1 billion for the Berkshire Hathaway team. Are you that patient? I don't know many people who are. Instead, the money is burning a hole in your pocket and you want that investment opportunity right now. Let's say that you just inherited $1 million. One of the first questions that should come to your mind is, how should this money be invested? But if I told you to sit on it until something comes up at an attractive price, you would look at me like I was crazy. If you phoned a stockbroker, more than likely he would have all kinds of ideas, because if he didn't have a lot of ideas, you would go find one that did. Fund managers and individual investors all have a difficult time sitting patiently, waiting for the perfect pitch. Sure, they may know what a perfect pitch looks like, but waiting is something you do in an airport. After a while, their impatience sends them wandering off, conjuring new images of the perfect pitch. Before they know it, they have jettisoned the old and eloped with the newest trend. If people choose their spouses as they do their stocks, no marriage would last a week. Can you imagine listing all the attributes you'd find desirable in a spouse and giving yourself only 1 week to come up with a candidate you want? You wouldn't do it. And you would tell anybody who suggested it that they were crazy. Yet this is what happens all the time in the investment game. You know this is true, because if I gave you $1 million tomorrow, you would immediately be out trying to invest it. Maybe in a certificate of deposit down at the local bank, or maybe a stock purchase through your broker, who, by the way, would be more than happy to suggest numerous ways for you to profit from his wisdom. Every day you would read in the Wall Street Journal about some stock that doubled in the last 6 months, and you'd be wondering why you were not on that ticket. It takes only one, you know. Got to keep that money working. But changing investment strategies in midstream is a lot like trying to change careers in midstream. Let's say you are training to be a doctor, and after 4 years of school, you read about some lawyer who made $1 million, and you decide that lawyers make more money and that you want to be a lawyer. So you drop out of medical school and enroll in law school, and after a year or two, you discover that MBAs on Wall Street are making a huge amount of money, and you decide to become an MBA instead of a lawyer and drop out of law school and enroll in business school. The scenario could go on forever, and the result would be that you would end up with nothing. Whereas, if you had stayed in medical school, you would now be a doctor making good money. The same applies in the business world. You don't see Ford Motor Company trying to build computers, and you don't see IBM trying to build cars. Each has its own way of doing things, and each has its own products, and each spent years learning its businesses. Berkshire Hathaway owns two distinctly different businesses that are only a few miles apart and are run by families related to one another. One family runs one of the largest jewelry stores in the United States, Borsheim's, and the other owns the largest furniture store in the country, Nebraska Furniture Mart. Because each business is so specialized, the management of one would be lost trying to run the other, and vice versa. Acquiring the necessary acumen to run the business would be enormously expensive and would probably severely damage both businesses. The same applies to investment strategies. It takes a long time to learn the subtleties of what you are doing and to be able to distinguish investment situations that are truly opportunities from those that invite folly. Are you a market timer, arbitrage player, day trader, emerging growth strategist, old-school Gramian, or new-school Buffettologist? Each strategy has its rules, and jumping from one to another is like constantly repeating the first grade. Warren so subscribes to this theory of waiting for the perfect pitch that in 1971, when the market was really high, he folded up his investment fund, telling his investors that the strategy he had been using was no longer applicable to the market in which they were dealing. Instead of going forward with another strategy, one he was not comfortable with, he closed up shop and returned the money to his investors. For 2 more years, the market stayed high and many people made tons of money on what was a wild ride. But Warren just sat there on the sidelines, waiting. Then one day it happened. The market bombed and stocks sank like bricks. And who was waiting at the bottom of that pit of fear but Warren, loaded for bear, that is, loaded with cash to buy into a bear market. And as he has said, suddenly Wall Street was giving things away, and his business perspective investing strategy told him to start swinging his money bat at what were some unbelievable pitches. Probably the greatest pitch he swung at during this time was the Washington Post. The bottom line of all of this is that you must stay with the strategy and not waver from it if you are to stand strong when all the doubting Thomases are shouting, "Fire!" and jumping ship. It also means that when the whole world is seeing gold under every rock, you let sound business perspective judgment dictate your buy decision, and not the mad enthusiasm of the crowd. So be patient and wait for that screaming buy pitch. It will come. And remember that it is the stock market pessimism, not optimism, that throws the most profitable pitches. If you find you have a knack for Warren's way of investing, you might want to find investors to join with. Where should you look? Warren started with family and friends, and that is where anyone should start. Charity begins at home, and home is the first place to look for potential investors. After you have covered the home turf, you need to start approaching anybody you know or don't know who has money. Warren used to throw little investment get-togethers at his house. Susie, his wife, would put on a pot of chicken soup and invite people to hear the wisdom of the young investment genius espousing the wisdom of Benjamin Graham. After Warren was in business for a few years, he started raising the amount required of potential investors to get into the partnership. Remember, you are limited to 100 investors, so you want the wealthiest investors in town to be your limited partners, and you especially want the people who are making money, like doctors. Warren was famous for holding court with his doctor friends at a little chicken dinner place called Rose's Lodge. A plate of fried chicken, a few beers, a couple of words of Grahamian wisdom, and the checkbooks would come dancing out. Several of those early investors are now worth over $100 million. Actually, Lawrence Tisch became a limited partner and made some big money after he caught wind of Warren from Howard Newman, who had been Graham's partner at Graham Newman. Now, back in the old days when income taxes were 50% or better for high-income types, it was advantageous to invest through a corporation, which was taxed at a lower rate. The only catch was that you could not own more than 49% of the company, or the IRS considered it a personal holding company, and would tax you at personal income tax rates, which were, yes, 50% or better. The problem with personal holding companies still exists, so watch out. So Warren went out and bought himself 48% of a textile company called, you guessed it, Berkshire Hathaway. The textile business, though once great, was a commodity business, and Berkshire's mill just couldn't compete. Warren, upon seeing this, did a very smart thing and started buying insurance companies with the working capital of Berkshire. In essence, money that at one time would have been put into new looms was spent buying the National Indemnity Insurance Company. Why insurance companies? It's not that they are such a great buy. The economics of the business attracted Warren. An insurance company makes money from the pool of funds, or float, by investing it. And what is Warren great at? Investing. In 1996, Berkshire's insurance business had acquired a float of $6.7 billion. This means that in 1996, Warren had the free use of $6.7 billion worth of other people's money. Money that someday would go to pay claims, but till then was free for Warren to invest with. The key to making $1 billion in the investment game is to learn how to make an average compounded rate of return of 23% or better. Start a limited investment partnership, inspire your investors, and after you get enough money, buy yourself 49% of an insurance company. P.S. I almost forgot. You have to get your friends to buy the other 2% of the insurance company, so that you can effectively control 51% of the voting stock of the company, which means you get to control the board of directors, who in turn control the company. Sounds easy? It was for Warren, and it might be for you, if you let business perspective investing guide the way. Well, you've made it to the end of the program. Hopefully, we have done our job and have given you a new understanding of the history and tools that go into being a Buffettologist. For those of you who want to know more, we recommend the popular Internet Buffett Watch website, which does an excellent job covering all things Buffett, and can be found at www.buffettwatch.com. That's one word, capital B, capital W, on the World Wide Web. We leave you with this final bit of advice. If you really want to learn concepts behind business perspective investing, you probably will have to listen to this tape more than once. It's a paradigm shift in thinking about investments, and therefore takes time to sink in. If you're interested in learning the mathematical formulas behind Warren's business perspective investing, You might consider looking at the book version of this Buffettology program to study the quantitative section at the back. It is not difficult to learn the math, but you need to see the formulas in writing while holding that special calculator in hand. Then you'll be able to make those judgments, to buy or not to buy, with the cold hard facts right at your fingertips. Buffettology does take some effort to master, as does any strategy that works. But once mastered, it can be very rewarding. I'm Mary Buffett. Thanks for listening, and good luck in all your investment endeavors.
Buffettology. The previously unexplained techniques that have made Warren Buffett the world's most famous investor was written by Mary Buffett and David Clark and read by Mary Buffett. It was abridged for audio by Marty Goldenson. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Rick Bradley. The associate producer was Florence Barreau Adams. Buffettology was produced and directed by Susan Perrin. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Buffettology. The previously unexplained techniques that have made Warren Buffett the world's most famous investor, by Mary Buffett and David Clark, is available in hardcover from Scribner.